Government Operations and Elections Committee will come to order. Just a little bit of housekeeping before we start. We have the room reserved until our usual time. We have three bills on the agenda. If we don't finish, we will come back at 1 o'clock in 500 South. So hopefully we can work through these bills this morning. Representative Simon, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I will move the minutes.
Representative Simon moves the minutes of April 26th. Any comments or corrections? All those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved. The first bill we will take up is House File 705. Representative Murray, would you like to move the amendment for Representative Crawford, or move the bill, excuse me?
Madam Chair, I'll move House File 705 be recommended to pass and be forwarded to the Judiciary Committee.
So moved. Representative Crawford, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a delete all amendment. Hope we have a copy of that.
Representative Murray, would you like to move that?
Madam Chair, I would also move the DE1-1 amendment.
So moved to your delete everything amendment, Representative Crawford.
Thank you. This bill is a mandate relief bill that the cities and counties and school districts have asked us to consider adopting in the age of when we're going to be cutting back on some of our things to the state and local governments. It would be prudent, I think, to consider some of these things that counties and cities and school districts have asked us to do. And what I'd like to do, there are a number of provisions here. I'm kind of reading off the House research summary, and I'll very quickly go through the nine sections, and then we'll go through them maybe one by one, because we have people here to testify on some of them. So section number one is very similar.
Yep. Representative Crawford, would you like to pass the amendment, and then since it's the bill you want to work from, and then work from that, have that out of the way?
Which amendment are you talking about?
The DE1, would you like to pass
yes.
that first?
Yes, I would.
And we'll have it in the shape you'd like?
Yes.
If that would be okay with members, we'll just pass that, and then we'll be working from the correct document. Any discussion?
I do have, Madam Chair. Okay.
All those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Now the document is in the shape you'd like to work from, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section number one is similar, the same thing that the bill of Representative Murray, permitting counties to use CPA firms to do their audit. Number two is a technical amendment that can be explained by one of the testifiers here. Number three is getting rid of reference and reporting requirements for 3-2 beer to the state. Number four changes the language to from shall to may on cities requiring a state building code administrator. Number five changes the definition of a qualified newspaper. Number six is again technical, which can be explained by a testifier that will be here. Number seven is a controversial piece that will allow cities and counties to put legal notices on the a designated website rather than on a newspaper. And number eight, let's see here. Number eight is getting rid of a requirement to publish more than once the county board salaries and per diems. And number nine is a repealer. I'll go through those very quickly. The first one, 279.07, 279.8, are having to do with the bid process for county publications. The next one, 326B, is one I would like to remove at some point through an amendment. Basically, that is an amendment, statute that the building industry would like to know what the fees that are collected from cities, what they're spent on. And we originally had we're going to remove it, and but we'd like to keep it in now. So it is not, so we won't want to repeal that. The next one is a report to the Commissioner on Liquor Information. 375.17 is a requirement to do a report in a second newspaper. 382 is a kind of an archaic statute that tells counties how to hire additional clerks. Chapter 395 is all to do with the county seed program, which it is obsolete now. And then the last one is a repealer of a health benefits contract, and we can explain that as we go along. So I guess I'd like to go in order of the sections, and I would call for a testifier.
Okay, that would be fine. You could have them come forward and...
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. Again, if you could just identify yourself once again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll kick things off here. My name is Jennifer O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We're the statewide organization representing cities here at the Capitol. And first and foremost, I'd like to thank Representative Crawford on this bill, but also Representative Druskowski, who has really bird-dogged this issue since before session, quite frankly. As you know, House File 7 was one of those bills introduced, I think, the very first days of session, and its mandate relief has certainly been a topic from both caucuses, but even more so this year with the very severe budget situation the state faces. And if I could just put this on the record, I think these two bills are very important pieces of legislation, but they really help set the stage, if you will, Madam Chair, for what the legislature and then us as local government associations and such need to be doing in the next couple of years on this topic. There's a lot of work to be done. As you'll hear today, there's an interest group and an association of some sort for every single mandate or whatever that's in statute. And these are important conversations to have. Real quickly, Madam Chair, there are a few things in this bill that affect cities and then counties and then both of us. If it's okay, I'll just go in order through my notes on some of the things that we support.
That would be fine.
Section 4, dealing with the building official to administer the code. We are certainly supportive of this permissive language with cuts and such both on the service level and with fees and tight budgets. We're interested in seeing this permissive language for the building code piece move forward. For a long time, cities and counties and other local governments have been interested in flexibility, if you will, the permissive language that's in this delete all that lets cities use their websites for some of the publication requirements that are required for cities. We worked hard in the delete all language to address some of the concerns around special assessments and stuff and some of those items that do cause more controversy or need more public awareness, if you will. Jumping down into the repealer sections, we understand that Representative Crawford would like to take out the building fees report piece. We, of course, would like it to stay in, but maybe that's something we can work on in the years to come. I do have somebody here from the League of City who is an HR manager. Her name is Lisa Rund, who will speak directly to the aggregate value of benefits piece. And I'll be around for questions if that's okay.
Thank you. Yep. We'll take your next witness then.
Okay. I think we'd like to do the audit next, since okay. we have people here. And is Gino here?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Gino Fragnito, the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota CPA Society. We're the professional association for approximately 9,400 CPAs across the state of Minnesota. And I'm here to offer our support for the section of the bill that would allow the counties to provide to have their audits done by a private CPA firm. Current practice, there are some counties that are allowed to have their audits done with the CPA firm. That seems to be working, and our members feel that the opportunity to do additional audits would be beneficial to not only the state but also to the profession.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is Carolyn Holmstrom here?
Welcome to the committee. You can please identify yourself.
Good morning. I'm Carolyn Holmston, the finance director for Goodhue County.
Oh, I'm sorry. What was the last name?
Holmston, H-O-L-M-S-T-E-N.
Thank you.
And thank you for the opportunity today to let you know that we really are very interested in your support from the county side of things. This bill would allow us the opportunity to have local option in providing our audit from someone other than the Office of the State Auditor. It's not an issue relating to the staff members themselves. We work with very pleasant individuals. However, there are 4 points I'd like you to please consider. Number one is cost. As you're all concerned with your budgets, we are too, and we're watching them very closely. A recent informal survey that was conducted with county auditors to learn more about what are their audit costs from 2005 to 2009. Granted, it wasn't scientific. So did everybody say, you know, in our case, we use calendar year costs. So did the other counties use calendar costs or for the actual audit year? But the results are pretty clear. There were 31 responses. 17 of those used the Office of the State Auditor. 14 of those used private firms. The average annual cost for those that use private firms was $19,000 less per year for the audit. Over 5 years, that's $95,500 plus, which could be used for other county needs. This reason alone is pretty compelling on the current economic conditions for you to please consider this bill. Secondly is consistency. At this time, counties are not required to seek all advice from anyone when they're dealing with legal issues. They don't have to go to the Attorney General's office. Why do we need to go to the state for the Office of the State Auditor? Likewise, cities that are not in the first class and school districts currently do have the option to go with a local audit firm. So we would like to be treated and handled exactly the same way from the county perspective. Third has to do with flexibility. We've had cost, we've had consistency, and now we have flexibilities. Both parties of the audit must work together for timeliness, when these documents can be prepared and when they can be reviewed. Depending on the local government staffing levels and the staffing levels of the various offices under the oversight of the state auditor, the two schedules may not always produce a timely result. With the addition of the private sector auditors, there may be more flexibility in meeting these needs of a shrinking local jurisdiction staff. Nationally, there's much more talk on the timeliness of audits. Users are looking for this current information that is sometimes available early on in the year, many times not. And the last point is quality. The quality of audits are not going to diminish whether you use a private firm or whether you use the Office of the State Auditor. They all must follow the generally accepted auditing standards, which in their actual audit letters say are issued by the Comptroller of the United States. So an audit's an audit. It includes a variety of procedures to be completed, documents to be reviewed, and questions to be asked. To what extent this is done is up to the interpretation of those professionals that are performing the work. So with due respect to the Office of the State Auditor, as long as the work is performed following these national requirements, I would like this committee, as well as the House and Senate, to give counties the opportunity to select who they work with to perform this important function as we proceed on an annual basis. Thank you.
Thank you. If you could just stick around, we have a couple of questions for you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. In the testimony, you brought up cities not in the first class. I'd like to work with the author to maintain the new city of the first class, would like to maintain its present auditing activity and relationship and not lose that. So is that something that author would be?
Representative Crawford.
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and Representative Quam, we would be able to do that.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And my question was for Ms. Holmston. If 17 of these counties are using the state auditor and 14 are using private, why do we need this bill? Are they doing it with an unpermitted, or are they doing it with the permission of the state auditor, or how have they been able to use
my
private auditor?
My understanding is there was a time when the state auditor's office was interested, back in the early 2000s, of allowing some to go private to work with their schedule. No, that's my understanding. But I have talked to counties who have been rejected by the state. You have to get approval from the state auditor's office that says, please go, may we go private, and they've been rejected.
Senator Scalzi.
And then my second question would be regarding the question that just came up with Representative Quam. If you're a city of the first class, how would you change that in the bill to say cities of the first class except Rochester? How would you do that? Because otherwise then Duluth is going to say, why not accept Duluth? I don't understand how you would do that. You're either first class or you're not. Your population determines that.
Representative Quam, did you want to answer that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, population no longer determines that because there was grandfathering effect to allow Duluth, even though they dropped below a couple of cities not of the first class, to maintain that. This is grandfathering standard operating procedure for that city and allowing them to maintain the activity and relationship they have in their auditing. And so therefore, it would prevent them from gaining additional onus from the state. And so grandfathering has been utilized in cities of the first class to Duluth's benefit at their request. So they're still a city of the first class. And I'm just asking that we do the appropriate language to allow grandfathering for the city of Rochester with practices that they have in place.
Any other questions for Ms. Holmston? Okay. I think we'll thank you very much. We'll move on to the next witness then.
Madam Chair, I don't know if you want to see if there's anyone here that wants to testify against that particular section.
Okay, we'll do that next. If there's somebody that would like to speak against the bill or a section of the bill, this would be the appropriate time to come forward. Yep.
Yeah, that section.
Just that section.
Yeah, that section.
If you want to testify against any section of the bill, this would be a good time to do it, including the newspaper section.
Okay.
For example, not to suggest what you may want to speak to, but this would be the time.
Senator Crawford sounded like he just wanted to handle that one section at a time, so that's why I sat down again. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Naren. I'm with Meserly and Kramer, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association. The Newspaper Association is the trade association for all 370 newspapers in the state of Minnesota. We have some concerns about certain sections of the Delete Everything Amendment. I understand there is an amendment to take out some of the provisions that deal with public notice, and not all of them, I think, are handled in the amendment. So I will proceed as if the amendment hasn't been put on yet and just give you some broad concerns with the proposal. I do want to thank Representative Crawford and Representative Drazkowski. Both of them have been extremely generous with their time and meeting with us to discuss our concerns with this proposal.
I have done work for the Newspaper Association for 29 years now, and have had the opportunity to work on a lot of legislation over those years. There have been many proposals and many bills passed to make significant changes to the public notice statutes. In fact, one of the first bills that the Newspaper Association brought forward was a bill that repealed over 300 statutes that required public notice. And the reason we did that is we thought they were meaningless or obsolete provisions, and we didn't want to be in the position of defending any kind of public notice or expenditure of public money that we didn't think was meaningful. Since that time, we have brought forward a number of other bills that have also repealed additional requirements in law that required public notice. We've worked with the state auditor to hone down the notices, to put them in new formats so that they're meaningful to the public. So we only want to defend notices that we think are meaningful to the public. To us, this issue is about transparency in government. Public notices have been required to be in newspapers since our country started. Over time, most newspapers have adapted to changing times. They all have websites. Public notices have been on websites and newspaper websites for many, many years. In fact, Minnesota law now requires that all public notices that go into print editions of newspaper also by law must go onto the newspaper's website. We've started tracking the use of newspaper websites, and quite frankly, I've been astounded at some of the results that we've received lately. Outstate newspapers, the West Central Tribune in Willmar, the Rochester Post-Bulletin, the Austin Daily Tribune, Le Sueur newspaper, are all getting well over a million visits a month to their newspaper websites. We've compared this with the use of government websites, and it's statistically almost insignificant. One example, the Rochester newspaper had over a million visits just in the month of December. 372,000 of those were unique visits, in other words, from different computer systems. The city of Rochester during the same one-month period had 4,000 unique visits, 4,000 versus 372,000 to the newspaper websites. So you can see that there's a vast difference in the public's acceptance and the use of newspapers and newspaper websites. I think in your handouts that we've passed out, there are editorials from a number of newspapers around the state. There's also some separate letters from Association of Retired Persons who are opposed to taking public notices out of the print edition of newspapers. Seniors in larger demographics tend to read these notices in the print edition and prefer them to the newspapers. But as you can see, the newspapers are where people go. There's also a state fair poll result in there. I think the year before last, the Senate asked the question during the state fair, what is the number one way that you receive information about your government? If you can see the results, newspapers were overwhelmingly number one. That is still where people go to receive news about their government. So we do have concerns about any proposal that would remove them from the print edition or from the website of newspapers, because we think this is where people go to find out their news, to read their news. Over the years, when there have been other bills here, we've actually advocated for amendments that would mandate that notices also go on government websites and go in other places where, however people get their news. We don't think newspapers should be the exclusive way, because some people get their news other ways. Historically, the local governments have opposed any of those proposals that have been put forward in prior years by legislators to mandate that they go on government websites and that they be available in other ways. So we are certainly open to that. And over the years, I've met with my friends who lobby for the local governments many, many times, and we're always there's always discussions about public notice, and there's always discussions about how to best get the news out, and they regularly come to us with press releases and information about their local governments, asking them to be put in newspapers, asking for assistance with that. So even they recognize that the best way to notify the public about what government is doing is through newspapers and newspaper websites. They don't just post them on their own websites and pray that somebody will see them. So that, in essence, is some of our arguments. I'd like to turn it over to some real people who are here, who are not lobbyists, people from the newspaper industry and the printing industry who have some concerns also.
We have a few members that have questions, if you wouldn't mind sticking around for just a minute. Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find your testimony interesting, and I would agree that, especially with the documentation handed out, with circulations down in print, that the papers actually are getting much greater outreach through their websites. So I wonder if there is some sort of a step or compromise of where you reach more people and there's a lower rate, that they would be able to do it on the website of the newspaper as opposed to the print version. That's just a thought, if that might be some work that you could do. Thank you.
Ms. Theron?
That's certainly an option. Again, that would be only internet access. You wouldn't have a print edition for those who prefer to get their news that way, who don't have computer access, who don't have internet access. And print editions, while some papers have decreased circulation, a lot of them are holding fairly stable also. So they are being read. The print editions are being read. The other concern also is if you only have internet public notice, there are legal consequences to not having an official affidavit of publication to back up what is published in the paper. In prior years, when these bills have been discussed here, both the state auditor and the attorney general's office have voiced concerns about only having an internet copy of a public notice, because frequently what happens with some of these notices that deal with serious issues like bond issues, like school closings, ordinances going into effect, sometimes they become the subject of audits or they become the subject of litigation when a citizen challenges a bond issue or challenges an action of a local government. So having only an internet copy can present some problems, and I guess we'd encourage against just that, even if it is the newspaper doing it.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I agree with you, Ms. Theron. And just in response to Representative Quam, I mean, this letter from the AARP that's in our packets, I think, really states it very clearly. There's still a huge digital divide in this country. I was stunned that 38% of adults age 65 and older do not have or only 38% go online for information. And then in the general population, there's still a quarter of the population that does not go online for news sources. So, you know, unfortunately, I think the divide is both urban and rural. I think there's income characteristics, there's demographic and age characteristics, but we still have a large, surprisingly large number of our constituents that are not online or certainly don't go for news online. So this issue seems to come up almost every year. It certainly has since 2002 when I've been, since I've been in the legislature. And, you know, until these numbers come up, there's a lot of the population that's not going to see these notices, as well as other things that are only offered in the print version of newspapers. So just wanted to make that comment, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair? One thing I would additionally draw your attention to, in the smaller packet that was handed out, there's two articles in the back that are extremely timely right now. As some of you know, there's a lot of controversy about legislation that was just passed in Wisconsin dealing with some controversial provisions on changing rights, union rights, and others that were the subject of a lot of protest. The judge has set aside that law, and the basis for her setting aside the law was inadequate public notice. So not giving proper notice has many ramifications in Minnesota law. As you probably all know, the statutes in Minnesota are replete with requirements to publish notice before local governments can take certain actions. All those provisions were put in law by you, the legislature. The Newspaper Association has never advocated for one of those notices. Those are your decisions to give public notice. In fact, one of the good bills that you just passed yesterday, Representative McFarland's bill, I think that was drafted by the Association of Minnesota Counties, permitting them to do some innovative stuff, that has a new public notice requirement in it, I noticed. So you're making the decision when you think things are important that public notice is required. Make that clear.
Don't go anywhere yet. You still have more questions. Representative.
Are there more questions?
Representative Erdahl. So you come up to the witness table, you never know when you'll be set free again. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and more just a quick comment than a question, and that is to, you know, I have concerns too from the seniors that I've heard from, that they don't have internet access, or they don't choose to have internet access. The time is coming where, you know, we may not use paper for hardly anything, but I'm not sure if that time is here yet. You know, I'm concerned about small newspapers that people depend upon in my district and others that have maybe only 8-10 pages in the paper, and two or three of them are legal notices, which are important to the livelihood of that paper and also important to the people, many of whom, again, are not utilizing the internet.
Thank you. Not yet.
Not yet.
You're an antsy one. Representative Scalzi, and then Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I guess my question is for Representative Crawford. If AARP, and I really share the comments that were just made by Representative Erdahl, this is what I'm hearing from people in my district, too. They don't want the local newspaper to fold, because if they lose the legal notice funding, then the people are not going to see the first and second page, which is what they really like. And they like to read the police reports. They like all of it that's in the local paper. But for Representative Crawford, if the AARP says only 38% of adults 65 and older go online nationwide, do you have any figures from Minnesota when you constructed this bill? Do you know how Minnesota compares? Because they're saying that... it may be lower in Minnesota. So what is the figure that you know of?
Representative Crawford?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scalzi, no, I don't have any numbers from AARP. I know, I acknowledge it's a problem. One way we try to address it in the bill is that if someone requests to have legal notices sent to them, and let's say the county decides to use this option, then the county is responsible for sending those legal notices to those people. So, but I acknowledge it's a problem.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Crawford, thank you for bringing forward some reform here for us today. I appreciate the opportunity to look at that. One of the things I would like to do, if it's all right, at this time, if you're open to it, is I'd like to share an offer. The A1 amendment, which deletes sections 5 and 7 from your bill on pages 3 and 4. My rationale for doing that would be that, as we're starting to hear a little bit today on some of the testimony, that not everybody has internet access. And I know that in my district, there's a large number of people that don't have access. And so I'm wondering if you would be open at this time to considering such an amendment to delete that language from your bill.
Representative O'Driscoll has moved the H0705A1 amendment. Representative Crawford, to the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Driscoll. I do, I would like to have the testimony, I guess, of the people that support it yet. And we have three or four people that are here to testify, and they'll probably take about a minute or two each. And I guess I'd like to have those first, and then we could maybe move ahead with that, if that would be okay.
That would be fine, and I think Ms. Niren has a few more people she would like to have an opportunity to speak as well. So, Representative Crawford, I guess you're the author, so would you rather have the proponents or the opponents speak first?
We can go with the proponents, Madam Chair. That would be great.
Okay. So would the...
We could have County Commissioner Rhonda Savaraji from Anoka County. She's here.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Savaraja. If you could just identify yourself again for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rhonda Savaraja. I'm the chair of the Anoka County Board of Commissioners, and I'm here in support of House File 705 today. I'll keep my testimony short by focusing on just two sections of the bill, Section 5 and the repealer, Section 471 .6161 Subdivision 5, Section 8, which would provide significant cost savings to local government. Section 5 in particular is really about good government. And I think if you look, there's been some discussion about the newspapers and losing revenue from local governments. I think we have to look at this as a free market enterprise system. And I think that you will see that newspapers and publications will adapt, whether it's charging for their online website service. But it's not local government's job to subsidize different businesses. So Section 5 actually would allow local governments to post their minutes and other required notices on their websites in lieu of publication in a qualified newspaper. All notices with direct financial impact on individuals, such as eminent domain and special assessment notices, where there's not a direct mail notice, would continue to be published in a qualified newspaper. The alternative of web publication in lieu of newspaper publication offers significant savings for taxpayers. In Anoka County alone, it would be a savings of $85,000 annually, while improving access for the public at large, who now relies on the internet for much of their information. Currently, our official newspaper has a circulation of 8,900 households. We have over 335,000 people that live in Anoka County. They don't have access to the county designated newspaper. There is no newspaper that serves our entire county. So by publishing it on the website, actually, we're making it available to a greater population. Those without computer access can request a mail notice. Notice would also be available at the local public libraries and can be emailed to those who request it. For those who are a little skeptical of this change, I would simply ask, where do you get your local government information from right now? Frankly, do you ever go through and read all of the legal notice section of any newspaper that you subscribe to? Furthermore, wouldn't it ideally be nice to just be able to Google the information if you have a general question about one of your local governments? The web publication would actually make that possible. Contrast that with the current publication requirement, where you have to know what newspaper the information is actually found in. You need to, if you live on one side of the county, drive over to the other side of the county to a local newspaper stand to actually purchase it, acquire that publication, know what date the information was published on, if it's not searchable on the newspaper's website, if they even have one. And please note that newspaper publication does not serve to preserve the historical record. By law, local governments are required to maintain their records in perpetuity in many instances, and easy access to what record is currently available in newspapers is limited because the State Historical Society no longer microfilms newspapers because of their funding reductions. So would you like me to move on to Section 8? Or?
Well, I wanted to have the total amount of testimony to be a minute or two. That's okay. What I told Representative Crawford. So if you could wrap up, that would be helpful. Okay.
Just to go to Section 8, under current law, the aggregate benefit of the employee health insurance can never be reduced without the unilateral consent of the exclusive bargaining agent for the collective bargaining unit. And even if the contract has expired, and even if the insurer is demanding changes as a condition of continuing to underwrite the current employees at a level commensurate with the current premium. So it's a significant reform that would help local government and really help to level the playing field as well.
Thank you. All about that. Thank you. Representative Nelson, did you have a question for Commissioner Sivaraja?
Well, I guess I get a question and a comment. I find it disconcerting that the comment about the free market and possibly the having the website people start charging for information that citizens need to make informed decisions, that bothers me. The other piece of this is, as Representative Erdahl said earlier and Representative Scalzi, I'm hearing from my seniors that a lot of them do not have computer access. Some of them refuse to
They don't want to ever have to turn a computer on. In fact, there's a certain senator I know that has said that when he's no longer a senator, he will no longer have a computer. He chooses not to have that access. So, I mean, it's not just seniors that are in that situation. And so how are these people going to be able to Google something when they don't have a computer or computer access or even know how to do it? So I find that that problematic, and which is why I would support Representative O'Driscoll's amendment to remove that section from this bill, because there are still a large number of people, as the state fair poll that was here goes, that get that information, and that's the only place they get that information from. And we want to have sunshine in government. The other piece of your testimony that I find I have problems with is the talk about changing negotiated benefits. The health care benefits that employees get, I mean, I understand it would be great savings if we could just change all these and eliminate them, change it to a high deductible, but these are benefits that have been negotiated, and normally when you negotiate benefits to get better benefits, you give up money on the check to get these benefits, and now if the counties want to be able to come back afterwards and say, we're going to change that, well, are we going to give the money we saved back to the employees because that they paid for those benefits off of money that came off of their check in the first place to go to those benefits? Are we going to put that money in our pockets, and it's just a scam to take more money from employees? So I guess that's a concern I have for both of the prisons you've talked about, but the one about the newspaper and the publishing, until we get to a day when everybody's wired in and everybody has the access to computers and can get that information, to put it at a place where somebody has to be paid for it to get it, is disconcerting to me, because that's a way to hide what government's doing from the public, and we want to make sure we have as much transparency as possible in our government and what we're doing going forward, because that's how the public has the checks and balances on what we do.
Madam.
Commissioner Sivaraja.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson. My reference to charging for newspapers, there are many newspapers that now charge for you to actually access their website currently. However, not referring to the legal notice portion of that. Again, county governments do not charge, nor would we charge, to publish the information on the website. And again, we would make it available in our local libraries. We would actually mail it to individuals should they wish to have that information. And you know, we definitely support transparency in local government, and that is why we are doing more and more things with our websites all the time. We are doing more and more things with Facebook and with Twitter and all of the new technologies. I understand that there are individuals that do not have access to computer. I have individuals in my very own district that certainly share that situation. That being said, we would provide another avenue for people to have access to that information that, frankly, they're not getting now. The publication currently only covers a small portion of the county, and so most people actually aren't even receiving the information now.
Okay. Representative Nelson, a follow-up?
Follow-up, Madam Chair. And it's in Anoka County's a metro county and has good computer access, but I know, as some of our rural people have stated here, in some of the parts of the state, we do not have that same level of computer access. And again, going back, there are people that do not, and if they do not have computer access and they do not know that they can ask the county to get that information mailed to them on a timely fashion, it does them little good. And again, that's just moving us away from a transparent government.
If you could answer that briefly. I know we have several more people to talk on this, both for and against, and then we have to get back to the bill, and then we have several other bills for today. So if you could answer it briefly, and Representative Crawford, if your additional witnesses could be brief, that would be fabulous. You want to comment? Commissioner Sivaraja.
On the aggregate benefit issue, there are additional testifiers that would have more detailed information, I think, who would be most appropriate to be able to answer some of those questions in a more detailed manner.
Why don't we, at this time, take the next proponent.
Thank you very much.
And again, if you could limit it to just a short 2 minutes or less, it would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had prepared a three-minute statement, so I'll forego that, and I will just make a few comments on... I'm sorry. My name is Brian Olson. I'm a resident of Falcon Heights. Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this bill today. And committee members, I would like to bring up a few points here that have been touched upon, but I think what we're missing here is that this bill, the newspaper portion, it has two options. You can put your legal news notices on the government website, but you can also publish in a newspaper. We're not talking about eliminating the newspaper publishing aspect of this statute. Actually, this statute, and I've wondered this for years, as it is right now, it makes little sense because door-to-door delivery of the legal newspaper is not required. Now, it seems to me if the statute is, the intent of it is to create transparency in government and distribute information to the public, it's not being done. And I could tell you that Representative Nelson speaks about the rural aspects versus the metro, and I do agree that there is a great divide between the two. And the newspaper statute as it stands now favors the rural more than the metro, because the metro has changed so dramatically with the onslaught of internet access and so on. We're talking about two different things. I would think that in the smaller communities in the state, the people that are asking, like the constituents of Representative Nelson, they are asking for continuance of the newspaper publishing, and they can certainly get that. In the metro, however, I would like to talk briefly about my experience in as a resident of Falcon Heights and the Roseville area. We don't get the newspaper. It's very poorly distributed. It's the legal newspaper of Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, and Roseville. I've been to Falcon Heights council meetings where the council, the majority of the council, at two different televised meetings, admitted that they don't receive the newspaper at their homes. So you have the government themselves don't even get the paper. I also have noticed at Roseville City Hall, they sometimes don't get the paper there. Now, here's the legal newspaper of the city, and they don't always get the paper at City Hall. So the question of all of this is the availability and the distribution of the newspaper. I think in the rural areas, that distribution is much better because people subscribe to the paper. In the metro, they don't tend to do that. And in the metro, the legal newspaper, the bid process, the governments are usually giving these bids to obscure newspapers that just don't have a general distribution, and it's a lot different than a rural newspaper that is more widely seen. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee, and again, if you could just identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Kiselishan. That's J-O-H-N, and the last name is K-Y-S-Y-L-Y-C-Z-Y-N.
Yeah, I got that.
You can just call me John K. That'll work fine. I'm here today to speak in support of this proposal here. From 2000 to 2004, I served as mayor of the city of Roseville. I also have a background in website development and use. Now, I've always felt that legal notices are about getting information out to the community in the most efficient and cost-effective manner. Now, current law requires a newspaper publication even if it doesn't make sense in your community, which is why I support the proposal today, because it provides options. Now, in Roseville, we have good internet access, a library, public transportation. We mail every resident a city newsletter several times a year. We have one of the best websites in the state of Minnesota. We allow residents to sign up for several types of email notices. We also have a U.S. mail list where residents can get certain notices on announcement of council meetings mailed to them free of charge. We probably have more households with internet access than we have households receiving the community newspaper. We also have free access to government cable TV channels, which has community notices can easily be placed on it. Also, most notices published, legal notices that are published, were actually subject to extensive council discussion that had occurred previously, which the publication is the result of that council discussion. Now, in spite of this, from the handouts you see, we have been forced to spend taxpayer dollars on placing notices in community newspapers at a cost of $1,700 in the year 2010. Now, the review claims they have a circulation of 67%, but I believe most likely this includes papers that they leave at gas stations, at the library. The actual number of households receiving the paper, I believe, is far less. Also, this circulation includes papers that are tossed in the boulevards that oftentimes sit rotting for weeks. Now, from personal observation, the paper is not delivered to those who have a U.S. mail slot inside of their homes, live in apartments, which includes many senior citizens, or simply don't have a paper box on the street. Now, personally for me, my newspaper box got plowed under this winter. I did not receive the review for 4 months. Now, did I care? No, because frankly, the community newspapers in the suburbs are rarely a source of news and information. Half the paper is ads, the other half is press releases from various places. Now, certainly there are communities where legal publication is necessary. Roseville, I do not believe, is one of those places. Now, currently, the last statement I'll leave you with is that I believe under current law, if someone were to call City Hall and request a mailed notice, I believe the city has the right to charge them the 25 cents per page plus the mailing fee to mail them the notice. So if you're a senior citizen and you want these notices mailed to you, I think you would want this bill, because under this bill it requires that those notices be mailed to those senior citizens for free at no cost to them. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any more witnesses, Representative Crawford?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you for your indulgence. This is Reed Larson.
Is this your last witness?
Is
this your last witness, Representative Crawford? Thank you. Well, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dallas Larson. I represent the city of Centerville. We are a north suburban community of about 4,000 population, and our finances, like most cities, are stretched to the limit, and this is primarily a financial issue for us when we look at the publication issue of our notices. We spend, on average, over the last several years, about $6,000 for publishing notices. One single notice alone that we had to publish in the last year cost $600. And I would submit that most of the people that get the newspaper, the news from the newspaper, will get it from this news stories, not from the obscure notices that are out on page 9. But even so, the cost savings to us is significant, and we think that the citizens have a better opportunity for better notices through the website than they do from the newspapers. A recent example, we had to do some zoning changes as a result of our 2030 comp plan update. And the notice that went in the newspaper was this vanilla generic ad that had to go in to meet all the legal requirements. And I would bet that most people looked at that, didn't understand what was going on. But on our website, we had more information, and we had colored graphics that had a very good explanation of what it is we were trying to accomplish, and told them where they could get more information if they wanted it mailed to them. So I think that this is the time to make this change. We believe that our citizens are ready for the change in our community. Our official newspaper is published every other week, so it creates some complications for us even to work with that kind of a publication schedule. And an awful lot of the folks don't subscribe to the newspaper because there's costs associated with that. The county, I live in a different county. That county's official newspaper has a very high subscription cost, and I don't subscribe to it. So I wouldn't ever see the county legal notices in the county that I live in. So I would have to rely on other means of getting those county notices anyway. And I think that this is a matter for saving some money, provides this community with good benefit, and the newspapers will still do the news stories on those issues that are most important. And almost all of these notices that affect specific properties will get mailed notices directly.
Thank you. Ms. Naren, did you want to have a couple folks testify? welcome to the committee. If you could just identify yourself for the record.
I'm Chris Schultz, and I'd like to thank the chair and the reps, and specifically Representative Erdoff, for always taking the time to listen to me on a pretty regular basis. I'm the owner and publisher of several newspapers just west of here, from Delanower to Dassel, Darwin, Minnesota, and just south of there. And we've done the legal publishing for Wright County for many, many years. Now, I want to interject a little story regarding that. The board there has always been very supportive of what we do. The bidding process for publishing those legals in Wright County has made it very cost-effective for the county to do it. The day we went online as a newspaper back in the early 90s, we began archiving those legals on that newspaper site. That site is currently the most visited site within the county. 3 or 4 years ago, the county made an investment, improved their website. Part of that was to archive the legals on their site. Approximately a year and a half to 2 years ago, the county came back to us for that archiving responsibility of their legals, simply because it was more transparent, it was more cost-effective, and it was much more convenient. Moving on, in Delano, Minnesota, a community we publish in, to address a couple concerns and questions, there's two newspapers in Delano. We started a competing print newspaper with a website there 6 years ago, 5 to 6 years ago. Very quickly, we moved up to an almost 70% print subscription rate. The rate and cost for the city of Delano to publish in that newspaper is relatively low, and incredibly low compared to their overall budget. In a survey the city of Delano completed a year ago, conducted independently by a professional firm, endorsed and paid for by the city, the newspaper in its print version, 92% of the respondents said they prefer and want to get news about their city government from the newspaper. Delano just invested another $15,000 into an upgrade in their website, and in that same survey, 4 to 5% of those that responded get their news from the city website. Yes, there is a big difference between rural and metro. In the market area I serve, which is both, legal publishing in newspapers is still critically important. And if anyone has any questions, I would be happy to answer them. I'm a guy who deals with it every day.
Thank you. Ms. Nairn, is there anybody else that wanted to testify? Is this the last person? Okay, perfect. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is David Raji, and I'm the president and CEO of the printing industry of Minnesota. And just a quick comment, the printing industry of Minnesota, representing 700 firms, employing 28,000 people in the state of Minnesota, producing about $6 billion worth of product, and half of that hits the mail stream, including newspapers also are sent through the mail stream. Letters to the editor are one section of the newspaper that communities gather around and have a discussion. What appears in newspapers gets discussed. What appears on websites tends to be forwarded and forwarded and forwarded to a point of, is it credible or not? If government notices stop being printed, one less credible source of information for people in Minnesota will be lost, which may very well help feed the extreme views on some local issues. If printed, there's a sense of credibility. And I would think that local, county, state, government representatives would embrace channels of credibility wherever they could. Again, as the bill stands, without any amendments to Section 5 and 7, we would oppose it. With some amendments, we may be able to support it.
Thank you. Any questions for any of the witnesses? Okay, seeing none, I think we're probably ready for a vote on the H07 05A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, if I might, I just wanted to add something else to that. The rationale behind this, and I think it was made very, very well by even members of the committee, and my concern also is that we've been provided with some information on publication. Many of the, from my municipal experience, a number of the dollars that are incurred for publication costs come as a result of needing to post hearings on development and different things, which are costs that are passed on from the city back to the developer. So the process of going through and posting those kinds of notices isn't necessarily a direct city cost, because they are being reimbursed as part of their city ordinance or development policies. So yes, there are some hard costs that the cities or counties will need to incur, but I do believe that at this point, moving forward with removing sections 5 and 7 as the amendment suggests, is at this time still good public policy. And building on that same idea of publishing fees, I'd also ask for an additional oral amendment, if I might, on page 6, line 8, the reference to statute 326B145, and what that has to do is with municipalities needing to report the costs that they charge back to developers and contractors for these types of fees and services. I'd ask that that be removed, and I would also ask if that's a friendly amendment to the author as well this morning.
Representative Crawford.
Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll, yes, that is. That's fine with me.
Okay. Ms. Dyson, did you follow what he was wanting to do? Could you repeat his, I guess this would be a modification to his amendment.
Madam Chair and members, the oral addition to the A1 amendment is to add in page 6, line 8, delete 326B.145, semicolon.
Did everyone catch that change? Did anyone have any questions for Ms. Dyson or Representative O'Driscoll on that? Ms. Nairn?
Madam Chair, just one second. We do appreciate Representative O'Driscoll's A1 amendment. It does take out the most objectionable sections on publication of legal notice, but it does leave in about 6 different provisions on publication. The only one of real substance is the repealer on page 6, line 9, 375.17, subdivision 3. That does remove a publication that Mr. Carlson would like to remove from law. It's right behind me. That does remove a publication of a financial statement that currently is in law. The other 5 provisions that are remaining in the bill, I think, are technical, and we don't have any concerns with those being left in the bill.
Representative O'Driscoll, are you interested in modifying your amendment further?
Madam Chair, can I have an opportunity to testify, please?
I'd like to have the author of the amendment address the question first. Give just a minute.
I apologize. I didn't catch the reference, the statutory reference. Ms. Nearing?
Did you catch it, Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair, she is referring on the delete everything amendment, page 6, line 9, section 375.17, subdivision 3.
I guess that my spirit intent is to deal with all of the issues relative to sections 5 and 7. If this is germane to that, then I would include that as an additional oral amendment.
Okay. Representative O'Driscoll wishes to include the oral that to his oral amendment. Is everybody clear on the full amendment with the 2 oral modifications, or do I need to have Ms. Dyson restate that? Representative Quam?
I'm not exactly clear because my understanding is that in the repealer you're getting rid of some requirements. I'd like to know exactly what requirements of notification are being put back in with this oral amendment, especially considering it's oral and not in a piece of paper in front of me. So if staff can tell us exactly what requirements that would be repealed are not being repealed, that would be most useful in informing me as a member of the committee of what exactly is being done with this oral amendment.
Ms. Dyson, could you help clarify for Representative Quam what the modification does?
Madam Chair, members, the additional deletion of a repealer that was just mentioned, the Section 375.17 Subdivision 3 requires counties to publish financial statements in a second newspaper.
Representative Quam, does that answer your question? Okay. Now you wanted to testify?
Speak to that.
You could identify yourself.
I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association. The statute in question requires us to publish our financial statements twice. The elimination of the Subdivision 3 by the repealer would still require us to publish our financial statements once. So this is a very minor issue, but it is an expense for counties that we would like to have eliminated. Frankly, I believe we're the only level of government that are required to publish our financial statements, and it is a quite costly proposition, particularly under the current provisions of law, where we have to file not once, but twice. And this simply eliminates one of those instances.
Okay, any other questions about the modified 705A1 amendment? If not, I think we are ready to vote on it. All those in favor of the 705A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion does prevail. We are back to the amended bill. I think we were in the, when we had the amendment introduced, we were at the spot of having folks testify generally to the bill. Is there anyone else who wants to testify for or against the sum of the rest of the bill? Thank you, and if you could just limit your testimony to just a few minutes, that would be very helpful.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Rund. I'm an HR manager with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I am speaking in support of the repeal of 471.6161 Subdivision 5, which is the aggregate value of benefits. And just as a brief background, this law provides that all political subdivisions with union employees must obtain agreement of every union before making any reductions in the aggregate value of benefits provided by a group insurance contract. So insurance benefits have always been negotiable by the union, but this statute actually requires union approval changes even if those changes don't violate any terms of an existing union contract. And benefits have been interpreted by the Attorney General and also court cases to be very detailed, including deductibles and copays. So, for example, if Health Partners says to the city, we could give you a 5% decrease in your premium if you increase your office visit copay from $10 to $15 per office visit, the city really just has two options. First, it could go and try to get agreement from every single union to make that change, or it would have to be prepared to show that the 5% decrease in premium is equal to the same benefit of the $5 office visit copay increase. So in practice, that would probably require an actual aerial study to be able to determine that. And so the challenges that cities face are that numerous cities have told stories about having all the wide variety of employee groups agreeing and wanting a certain change, only to have one union group hold out and prevent the entire city from changing that plan design. And some of those changes are actually required by the insurance companies, which really puts cities and other political subdivisions really in a difficult position, because if Health Partners is requiring a change in provider networks or a deductible amount and the union doesn't agree to it, then Health Partners won't provide the coverage, and the city still doesn't have the legal right to change the coverage. A 2006 Minnesota Court of Appeals decision determined that even changing healthcare provider networks could be considered a reduction in the value of the benefits. So if this bill were repealed, insurance would still be a negotiable item under the union contract. Cities and counties and political subdivisions would still not be able to make any changes that would violate the union contract. And if the unions were not happy with the changes that were made, they could certainly bring that up during the regular negotiation process when their contract is open. So I thank you for your time and would be available for questions if there are any.
Thank you very much. I have one more person on the list of witnesses. Is that correct, Representative Crawford?
Madam Chair, that is correct. I have one other person, yes.
So Nancy?
Yes.
Obach? Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
My name is Nancy Hobach, H-O-H-B-A-C-H. I'm the Acting Employee Relations Director at Dakota County. Madam Chair, committee members, as was just mentioned, cities are dealing with difficult issues with rising insurance premiums. Counties are in the same situation. One of the difficulties with this aggregate benefits rule is that the definition of aggregate benefits has been interpreted very broadly. It can include network changes, and network changes obviously are very subjective depending on which providers individuals in the group might like to be able to access, in addition to increasing and decreasing deductibles, co-pays, co-insurance, or modifying the maximum benefit level of certain services. Because we need all of the exclusive reps to agree to a change or a perceived change, we have a difficult situation when there's multiple bargaining units. For example, Dakota County has 16 bargaining units. We spent almost a year with the group, a labor management committee of bargaining units, to make a change in our plan design that would be more affordable for the county and for employees, only to have agreement in the labor management setting. But once the unions took the issue back to vote, 15 of our 16 bargaining units rejected. So we are sitting with only one unit that has accepted a positive plan change in terms of cost for the county and employees, and moving forward is very difficult. As was just mentioned, it sometimes is very costly to have an actuarial study completed of a perceived aggregate value change. It can cost the county or city a great deal of money to have that changed, and then the exclusive representative still may challenge that. The repeal of the aggregate benefits rule does not affect employer premium contributions. We still would be negotiating the employer and employee contribution levels with the repeal of this. It would just simply provide us more flexibility in finding more cost-effective options in today's market. Thank you.
Thank you. I think that wraps up the witnesses then, for and against. Thank you. Did everybody?
Oh, I think we have some again.
Okay, if we could, so we've spent approximately an hour and 15 minutes on this bill, so I'd really like to wrap it up.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Jim Michaels. I'm a labor attorney. I represent public employee unions in the state of Minnesota, most of whom are representing firefighters and police officers. I'm here to speak against the repeal of the obligation to bargain over the diminution in value of aggregate benefits. That's MnSTAT 471-6161, subdivision 5. Benefit changes to health plans that reduce premiums invariably involve simply passing costs on to the covered employees in the form of increased out-of-pocket costs, expenses such as deductibles or copays. Taking away the employee's right to bargain over such changes constitutes a significant elimination of collective bargaining rights that will have a devastating impact on public employees. In recent years, the dollar amounts of the increase in health care costs have often been more than the dollar amount of any wage increase to employees. Thus, in terms of the dollar impact on employees and their families, taking away the right to bargain over changes in health plans is just as bad or worse than taking away the right to bargain over wages. The problem here is the cost of health care. The proposed repealer does nothing to address this problem. All it does is shift costs from employers to employees. The best way to control these costs is for management and employee representatives to partner together to fight the insurance companies. Otherwise, what happens is the insurance companies pass on double-digit increases and laugh while the employees and management fight with each other over who's going to absorb those costs. And I can tell you this from experience. I sit on labor management committees involving the state of Minnesota and its employees, the city of St. Paul and its employees, and the city of Minneapolis and its employees. And these collaborative efforts in partnership work. every year we sit together to consider and usually make plan changes to our health plans. And over the years, these changes have saved taxpayers and the employees that serve them millions of dollars. And our increases in premiums from year to year have averaged less than other public and private employers. I just came straight here this morning from a meeting with the City of Minneapolis representatives to discuss the negotiated plan changes that we've made for the Minneapolis employee plans that will save about $1.5 million a year from this point moving forward. This bill does not level the playing field. This kicks one of the teams off the playing field. Heard two other comments about bargaining. Insurance contracts come up annually, and they don't necessarily coincide with the bargaining cycle of labor agreements. So you could very well have the situation where labor and management sit down to negotiate for a Cadillac, and after they've agreed on how they're going to share the cost of that Cadillac, this bill would allow management to come back and say, you're paying for a Cadillac, but we're giving you a Chevy or a Yugo, if you remember that. You also don't have, as an employer, the requirement of all unions to agree, because if you've negotiated for plan changes and a substantial majority of the unions have agreed to make those changes, that, I think, is probative evidence that there has been no diminution in value of the aggregate benefit because you've negotiated a compromise for the change. In conclusion, members of the committee, Madam Chair, collective bargaining works. Please don't take it away.
Okay, does anybody have any questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I need to clarify a inaccurate statement that the testifier just made, that it takes away the bargaining right, that takes away a veto. Having been on a school board, not as long as some of our members, but having been on a school board and also been with a governing board of an association of seven school boards, I'm aware of the effect this has had, of where schools were forced into statutory operating debt because they weren't able to renegotiate health expenses because of a veto right. This taking away the veto right doesn't stop the parties from sitting down and saying, this is the pot of money we have, how are we going to redistribute it? How are we going to handle that? Next, I don't think anyone is laughing about the rise in cost of medical care, and to say the insurance companies are, you know, laughing. The rise of cost is based from cost shifting and other issues from some failed policies that we need to address. And to use that as a cheap way to attack a component of bill, I just, you know, you can tell I'm aggravated by that. So if you want to talk about actually what happens, then do it. But don't try and mislead me with your testimony. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if there's a question for me to respond to.
Mr. Michaels, I don't think there was a question for you to respond to. Any other questions from members or witnesses? Seeing no additional questions, Representative Murray renews his motion that House File 705, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Judiciary. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Aye. Motion does prevail. We will next move on to House File 7, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House Bill 7, recommend it pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski, welcome to Government Operations. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the opportunity to hear my bill today. Members of House File 7, which has some similarities to Representative Crawford's bill.
Excuse me, Representative Drazkowski, I see you have a DE2 amendment. Would you like to get that passed first so we can get your bill in the order you'd like it?
I do, Mr. Chair, and I think that would be good. One request, Mr. Chair, would be on the DE2 amendment. If whoever is offering the amendment would be willing to do so, on line 5.2 of the amendment, I would like to strike the same repeal provision that was struck in the last bill, and that is 326B.145, if that is the will of the mover of the amendment, Mr. Chair. 326B.145, if that could be removed from the repealer.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to move the DE2 amendment with the oral amendment on line 5.2 to strike 326.145.
Okay, we'll incorporate that into the DE2 amendment. Do you want to have Representative Sanders?
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, I believe this also has the other repealer in the section. I was just wondering if you had thought about removing that one as well as we did in the last bill or not. It was just a question because I know that we did. We removed two repealers on the last bill.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, it'd be the wish of the author, if we could, to leave it in and have further discussion about that.
Ms. Tyson, could you cover what we did there?
Mr. Chair and members, in the H0007 DE2 amendment, the additional to be incorporated into the amendment is page 5, line 2, delete 326B.145, semicolon.
Thank you. Are there any member questions? Representative Green, did you have a question on the amendment? Okay. Any additional member questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment. Representative Drazkowski, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, this effort around mandate elimination, members, began actually before session began. The original House File 7 and really a corollary, House File 519, actually represented a lot more provisions than these. Given really the what I've seen is an expedited approach here for the policy bills, given all the work that we have placed into the finance bills and in getting the budget passed, we're finding ourselves not with as much time as we'd like to do these. So this is an abbreviated approach from what we had actually in those two bills originally. So I appreciate your hearing these today. Members, as we met with several legislators, and actually I think there were over a dozen legislators and representatives of the local units of government in the interim, one thing really became clear. As we look at this relationship between state government and local units of government, there appears to really be what I would characterize as a dysfunction in which state government places all of these mandates upon local units of government and then tries to compensate them, or at least many of them, with local government aid. And we've seen some of those struggles throughout the last several months and part of the early part of the session. So what this is an effort to do is to remove some of those mandates, remove some of those burdens that state government places upon local units of government. And members, to the best of my knowledge, there is not a single component of this bill, as amended, that if passed today and signed by the governor, would not or would preclude the local unit of government continuing to operate in each of those areas as it is today. So With that, again, members, this is the bill. The changes, I can maybe just make that you point out the changes, Mr. Chair, from Representative Crawford's bill. Would that be helpful?
Sure. Go ahead.
The first notable one is on page 2. It's section 2, and that is the law library funds. It's been brought to my attention, especially Goodhue County, and I know there's others as well. Their law library has accumulated surpluses, and they are not allowed by statute to spend those surpluses in any other place except for the law library. In the age of the Internet and declining need for books and other types of things, it doesn't make a lot of sense to hold those counties to that mandate. This particular provision would allow those surpluses only in those accounts to be used by the courts to help defray some of the costs of the courts, and we know their situation today. It was mentioned, and I haven't looked at all the provisions. There are a couple, two or three newspaper provisions still in here. I guess I'd like to have Mr. Carlson maybe talk about those, but there are some redundancies in here that are in, not in the bill, but there are some redundancies that are removed with this bill, and one of those was talked about earlier, but I know Representative Sanders asked a question, but if Mr. Carlson could talk about those. In the light of the Internet, in the time of the Internet, and it has been testified in the earlier testimony that the newspapers now, and I've talked with Ms. Nearing quite a bit, the newspapers now have been publishing all their information online. It's on there probably forever, and the argument certainly has been made that they get a lot of traffic. So with these things being published on there once, I really don't see any reason for us to require them to publish again in their printed newspaper multiple times. But I'd be interested in Mr. Carlson talking about that if we could, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair.
That'd be fine. Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, members, really the only item...
Oh, could you identify yourself again?
I'm Keith Carlson with Minnesota Inter-County Association. Affecting publication left in here are Section 3 and the repealer of 279.07, 279.08, 375.17 subdivision 3, which we've already spoke of in section 9. The 279 references are basically just a process for publication of delinquent tax notices, where under current law has counties required to go through a separate bid process every year for publications of those notices. With the bill's provisions on that in Section 3 and the repealers of the 279 references, it just eliminates that separate bid process. They would still be required to publish in a qualified newspaper, actually twice, the list of delinquent tax payers. The reference in Section 9 and then the repealer of 375 gets rid of what I refer to as dual publication, where not only does the county have to publish once, they are required to publish twice, which again is an additional expense for the taxpayers. We think that publication once is more than sufficient, particularly with regards to our financial statements. Again, it's my belief that counties are the only level of local of government that are required to publish their financial statement, and it is a costly requirement, particularly since the current law requires us to do it twice.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Drozdowski.
If I could just continue, and thank you. The other notable area, I guess, that would deviate from Representative Crawford's bill are sections 7 and 8. Those are dealing with animal control mandates. Again, members, these These were brought to us by local units of government. They're asking for relief and the ability to enforce the laws in different ways or maybe at different frequencies than we are putting down these mandates, and that's the motivation behind these. And so, Madam Chair and members, those are the differences that I can see in this bill compared to Representative Crawford's.
Okay. Representative Nelson, you had a question?
No. Thank you. Yes, Ms. Madam Chair. Actually, I've got an amendment I'd like to do to the amendment, and that would be on line 5.4, page 5, line 4, starting at the after the and. Delete the 471.6161 and delete line 5.5. And I'd like a roll call on that. And Madam Chair, that's the as we talked about in the previous bill, that's the bit about the changing the benefit structure for the negotiated benefit structure without having to go to the exclusive bargaining agent. And again, like as I said on the previous bill, we're taking people's bargaining rights away. Their health care benefits are part of what is bargained for. It's part of their overall wage package, and to be making changes on that is making changes to the bargaining units, their contracts. So my motion is to delete those lines, and again, I'd like a roll call.
Okay, there is an oral amendment, and a roll call has been requested, so there will be a roll call. I think I'd like to ask Ms. Dyson to report the amendment and then verify the Representative Nelson's comments on what the amendment does.
Madam Chair and members, the oral amendment to the DE2 delete all amendment is page 5, line 4. Before 395.24, insert and then delete semicolon and 471.6161, comma, page 5, line 5, delete subdivision 5. And this is deleting the, from the repealer, the provision relating to reducing the aggregate value of that prohibits reducing aggregate value of benefits provided by a group insurance contract for employees covered by collective bargaining unless there is agreement.
Representative Drazkowski, to the Nelson oral amendment, could you speak to it?
I would speak in opposition to the amendment, Madam Chair. This was discussed earlier as a very important provision to create again some ability for local units of government to control their negotiations and to be again relieved of these mandates. This is a very important mandate for them.
Would anybody like to speak to the oral amendment at this time? Okay. Does anybody have any questions or discussion through the oral amendment? Okay. Everybody clear as to what the oral amendment does? Seeing no questions or discussion, all those in favor. Oh, sorry, a roll call has been requested. We'll take the roll.
Chair Pepin?
No.
Representative Murray?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Beard?
Nay.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hancock?
Nay.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative McFarland?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 9 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Back to your bill, Representative Drazkowski.
Really, I don't know that we have Any other testifiers, Madam Chair? Mr. Carlson or...
Madam Chair, I think on behalf of local governments, I will indicate that we all support the bill. To spare the committee's time, I don't think it's necessary for all the proponents to come up again.
Okay, I do have a couple of member questions at this time. Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jaskowski, what committees has this been to?
Representative Jaskowski.
Madam Chair and Representative McFarland, this is the first committee. It's on its way to judiciary next, I understand.
Okay.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've had some contacts from people that are concerned about some of the Section 7 on page 3 and Section 8 on page 4 about dangerous dog statutes and chain and this being a public safety possible problem when we change the word shall to may and the must to may. And also in the repealers, sections 346.14 and 346.15. I'm wondering, Representative Jaskowski, if you'd be willing to meet with the people that have an issue with that between now and your next committee to see if they can you can work some things out with them.
Representative Jaskowski.
Would be glad to, Madam Chair, and Representative McFarland.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. If it's appropriate now, Madam Chair, I have an amendment.
But is it an oral amendment? Or
no, no, one of the ones in our packet.
That would be fine.
Okay. I'll claim the A1 amendment, members. This is one I hope we can have broad agreement on. This has to do with voter ID, and whether you're for it or against it, that's not the issue. I don't think this is the time to refight that fight. But the latest local impact note does say that this is an $8.3 million cost to local governments. And since this is about mandate relief, and as Representative Jaskowski said, I was paying attention at the beginning, he said this is about, quote, burdens that state government places on local units of government, end quote. This is one of them. It's $8.3 million to our counties, our cities, and our townships. And whether you're for or against voter ID, I think you'll agree, in light of some of the testimony today, we've heard from cash-strapped administrators in counties and cities and other local units of government, it's only right that if we're going to impose a burden, a photo voter ID burden on those local units of government, we ought to at least help them pick up the cost. So I'm going to ask for a roll call on the amendment, and I hope to have your support.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Jaskowski, would you like to comment on the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that the amendment as presented, actually, Representative Simon, the A2 amendment is, I thought, a very good amendment. The A1 amendment, since things are not completely resolved about what the voter ID bill is going to look like or the costs associated with it, and the fact that I don't think that this is accounted for in a budget resolution. I don't know that it would be in order when it gets to the floor to Ways and Means. So I would encourage members to vote against the amendment.
Is there anyone that would like to testify to the amendment? Any further discussion to the amendment? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Jaskowski, the appropriation would be in order because the bill, the photo ID bill, appropriates money off the bottom line. So it'll go to Ways and Means, but there's, you know, I think the budget targets left something like $50 million for flood relief potentially on the bottom line. And the appropriation for the state share of photo ID comes from those funds. And so the $8.3 million from the local impact would also come from that same source. And there's plenty of money there, so there isn't an issue of being in balance with the budget targets. The real question is whether we choose to appropriate funds for that at all. And, you know, given that this can change, of course, we can change the appropriation line to fit the fiscal note or the local impact note. But the 8.3 is the local impact note. So it seems to me that if we were concerned about not passing this additional burden onto local government units, we could leave the 8.3 number in there. It could be changed if the bill changes and we have a local impact note to base that on. It all has to ultimately come through Ways and Means anyway. But there is money there. We don't have a balance issue, and but we do have a burden issue, and this amendment solves the burden issue.
Madam Chair?
Representative Jaskowski.
I would just add that, I don't know, Representative Winkler, what Chair Holberg would have to say about this. I haven't had a chance to talk to her about this, and you mentioned burdensome. I would not like an amendment like this to become burdensome to the bill. The spirit of the bill is to reduce local mandates. As I mentioned, I think the A2 amendment provides that intention and that direction from the legislature to move in that direction without potentially burdening the bill.
Thank you. I'm wondering if Ms. Frazier is here. I'd like to ask a question of the Secretary of State's office. She was here a minute ago. Well, Representative Simon, perhaps you know the HAVA account. Do you happen to know what the HAVA account is and if funds from the HAVA account can be used for such purposes?
Madam Chair and members, my understanding is, and I'm just going to give you a ballpark, there are a couple million or so left in the HAVA account. Some of that money is already spoken for, including in the bill as amended right now, both bills, both Representative Benson's photo ID bill and certainly Representative Kiffmeyer's photo ID bill, claim some of that, some large portion of that, to fund the state component of the cost. The rest are things like overseas military folks and outreach to them. So technically, is that fair game? Yes. But I think there's only $2, maybe $3 million left. Some of that's already spoken for. That's my understanding.
But
if other members know maybe different information, make it.
Representative Winkler?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct. And then the rest of the money to fund it comes from the general fund.
Okay. And then the dollar amount here, is that from the fiscal note from the from House File 210?
That's correct, Madam Chair, yes. That's right. That's the latest local impact note, subject to change, of course. And there may be, there will be another one. But this would be a placeholder for now. It may be higher, maybe lower than $8.3 million because Representative Kiffmeyer had to delete everything amendment. So the folks doing the local impact notes are trying to keep up with those changes. So we expect another local impact note to come. The $8.3 million is, though, just to be consistent, the most recent number that we do have. So rather than make up a number or guess, we're going with the one for the most recent local impact note.
Sure. Well, members, I think this is got some good intentions. I'm a little concerned about amending a bill that we don't have in front of us with the author of that bill not here. I feel that this is probably more appropriate to that bill as opposed to Representative Drazkowski's bill. So for those reasons, I will be voting against the Simon amendment today as well, intentioned as it is. Do we have any other comments or discussion on the bill before we take the roll call, or the amendment before we take the roll call? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin?
No.
Representative Murray?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Beard? Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hancock?
Nay.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative McFarland?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 8 ayes, the amendment is not adopted. We are back to the bill as amended.
Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler.
I'd like to move the A3 amendment, and I'd like to incorporate a change in the A3.
Representative Winkler moves the A3 amendment, and if you could state your oral amendment to the amendment.
Madam Chair, on line 2.12 through 2.14, which is really the place where the language has changed. On 2.12, I'd like to change the word must to may. And on line 2.13, after the word unit, I would like to insert a period. And I would like to strike the rest of the sentence on line 2.13 and 2.14. So, Madam Chair, the amendment would then read, the word dependence as used in this subdivision may be determined by the governmental unit, period.
Is everyone clear with the modification to the Winkler A3 amendment? Okay. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Drozdowski talked about allowing local units of government to control benefits and to relieve a state mandate. And strange as it is, it may sound, the statute, section 471.61, I believe it is. 6.1, subdivision 1, imposes a mandate on local units of government to include spouses and children as dependents. It doesn't give the government, local unit of government, any flexibility to decide that dependents may just mean a spouse or it may just mean children, so it doesn't give them the flexibility to offer lesser benefits. But I think more importantly, it doesn't offer them the flexibility to tailor their benefits to their employees and offer them dependent coverage that may be more consistent with the families that work for them. It's important to note that in Minnesota, 290 employers, so 290 Minnesota employers offer domestic partner benefits. But in state law, we say that local government units can't do that. They cannot define a domestic partner as a dependent. And that is a mandate that the state of Minnesota imposes on the local government unit to not include certain members of people's families. It takes away flexibility. It may be that they can negotiate lower overall benefit costs or lower salary increases if they offer a more flexible benefit package. And so I think we should remove that benefit, and I would ask for a roll call vote.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Drozdowski, would you like to comment on the A3 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Madam Chair, members, I don't support the A3 amendment. As a matter of fact, you know, we do in state law have various guidelines and standards that a lot of times county governments, I think, and city governments may look at this, Representative Winkler, as a mandate in itself for them to become engaged in a process and discussion that we often do at the legislature around the discussion around benefits and who qualifies for them. So I think this is one area that we don't want to be giving them, again, additional things that they need to do, additional decisions that the county and cities need to make. They've got their own business to do, and I don't think would be interested in this. So for those reasons, I'd speak in opposition to the amendment, Madam Chair.
Representative Winkler?
Madam Chair, Representative Drozdowski, it's pretty interesting that you would give them the flexibility to make their own decision, but you call the requirement to make an additional decision a mandate. So the best way then to eliminate mandates would be to remove all local discretion. And you might be interested in knowing that several municipalities in the state have passed resolutions specifically requesting the legislature to make this change, including the one I'm most familiar with is the city of Edina, has specifically passed a resolution from their city council requesting that we make this change, allowing them to more flexibly define dependents for purposes of their workforce. I hate to say it, but it just seems a little bit inconsistent that you think that local governments can make good decisions about benefits when it comes to collective bargaining, but not when it comes to dependents. It suggests that you're targeting one group and maybe targeting two groups for different treatment.
Representative Drozdowski.
Madam Chair, the bill targets several groups. It's counties and cities and school districts, and it targets the ability to remove mandates that the state government has already placed upon them. Representative Winkler, we had from those three groups many, many lists of requests from them for mandates to be removed. I never once saw this one on the list from the city, so you know, we haven't seen that request. This is the first I've heard of it. And I, as I look at the amendment, just in a cursory way, would really believe that if we would pass an amendment like this, we would be introducing into boardrooms, county and city boardrooms throughout Minnesota, the discussion around these very controversial issues, which would take up lots and lots of their valuable time. Again, Madam Chair, speak in opposition to the amendment.
Any other discussion to the amendment? Representative Green?
I'd just like to add to the discussion that I work in the private sector. I work for a Fortune 500 company, and you know, they're a member of the Chamber of Commerce, and I know we're taking plenty of the Chamber of Commerce's advice, and they offer partner benefits. And this is one way that I just don't understand why we as a state don't want to modernize, and yet we do look to the private sector for so many other good examples.
Chair, if nobody else.
Representative Winkler?
Yeah, I'd just like to add that, in fact, 70% of Fortune 500 companies in Minnesota offer these benefits. So it's certainly not controversial in the private sector. It's and it's not controversial among many cities who've already weighed into this and said they want to do it. And, you know, so the only place it's controversial is here at the legislature, not in the real world. And I wonder if we could hear anything from the League of Cities or Counties on this provision. I suspect that they've probably had it under discussion in the past.
Ms. Aurora?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. In the past, the League has actually testified in support of bills, I think, in the last couple years. I know I've been up at the stand. In favor of having that flexibility at the local level, because we do compete with the private sector, frankly, in terms of getting good employees in, and for a lot of folks, this is something they weigh in terms of who they want to go work for. So we would support the amendment.
Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin?
No.
Representative Murray?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Beard? Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hancock?
Nay.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative McFarland?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl? Representative Winkler?
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. There is looks like there's one other amendment in the pack, the H00078-2 amendment. Is anybody offering that amendment? Representative Sanders?
Madam Chair, if no one else is, I will offer the A2 amendment. Sounded like in earlier discussion that this is something that possibly the author had looked over and agreed with. I think this is a good amendment as well, as it doesn't nail down a specific cost, as we don't know a specific cost at this point in time. So I think this is a good direction to go into if the author feels that this is a good amendment.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I mentioned earlier, I am supportive of this language and encourage members to support it.
Madam Chair, I'd request a roll call on that as well.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Representative Green?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question to the author, so to speak. It sounds like an unfunded Band-Aid. Could you clarify?
Representative Sanders.
I don't believe that it's an unfunded mandate, and that we're saying the Secretary of State can help reimburse costs incurred to the counties, cities, and townships, and through that doing a survey to determine what that appropriate amount is.
So
Representative Green?
Thank you. Would you accept a friendly amendment that says, you know, and that money will be appropriated once the survey is completed?
Representative Sanders.
I guess I would defer to the author of the bill as well. I don't necessarily see a problem with that.
Representative Green, could you state, before we turn it over to Representative Draskowski, what would your intended friendly amendment be?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and please, Ms. Dyson, you know, coach me on my legalese here. but something that's like comma, and the legislature shall appropriate money to cover the costs as revealed by the cost survey.
Are you moving that, Representative Green, at this time, or are you just wanting to ask the author of the amendment and the bill if they would accept it? What are you looking to do right at this moment?
I'll move it.
Okay, Representative Green will move the amendment, and if you could report the proposed oral amendment to the amendment, Ms. Dyson, with the appropriate legal ease as requested.
Madam Chair and members, on the A2 amendment, if I understood correctly, line 1.8, is that where you were intending to put it?
Yes, I'm sorry, okay. Line 1.8, before the period, after the word government.
Okay, and the legislature shall appropriate, I'm sorry, I missed the rest of it.
Shall appropriate the costs as discovered or as
okay. The legislature shall appropriate an amount from. Do you want to specify a fund, or do you just want
the
to
general
say
fund
from an Seven. Amount from the general fund to the Secretary of State? To cover those costs. Let's
see. Is everyone clear on the proposed oral amendment to the A2 amendment? Perhaps, Ms. Dyson, you could read it back one more time.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, I think what I'm going to do is read the whole sentence, just
that'd be fine.
Starting on 1.7, the Secretary of State shall conduct a cost survey to determine the appropriate reimbursement for each unit of government, comma, and the legislature shall appropriate an amount from the general fund to the Secretary of State to cover those costs.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski. To the oral amendment to the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would speak in opposition to the oral amendment. Madam Chair, members, this would give the amendment really two different directions. One, on line 0.15, the amendment directs the Secretary of State to reimburse the costs, and then with the oral amendment, we would be asking the legislature to appropriate an amount. So I don't know that the amendment, if amended, would have a lot of clarity. There would be confusion, and it would seem to me that the Secretary of State, as the amendment was originally drafted, would be the proper place to have these dollars funded from. Representative Simon talked about the Secretary's accessibility to the HAVA dollars, and certainly with the Secretary conducting the survey would have really his pulse on those events. So for those reasons, I would speak in opposition to the amendment, Madam Chair.
Any other questions or comments to the Representative Hancock?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just think we're getting ahead of ourselves here. We're talking about what if and what if, and if this happens, then this will do this and we'll appropriate this amount. Requirements of the thing, House File 210, as amended, if enacted, I think we're putting the cart before the horse here. We're trying to get some relief on some mandates, and we're trying to interject another bill here that I don't think is appropriate at this time, just in general. I guess there's no question there, just a comment. I'm sorry.
Any Representative Winkler?
Well, Madam Chair, just to clarify, without this amendment from Representative Green, the A2 amendment simply requires the Secretary of State to eat the local implementation costs of photo ID. So it's not an unfunded mandate on a local unit of government. It's an $8.3 million cost to the Secretary of State without any without any access to resources to cover it. It's pretty, frankly, without appropriating money to the Secretary of State to cover it, it's pretty irresponsible. It's basically the legislature saying, well, we really want photo ID, but we don't want to pay for it, so we'll make somebody else pay for it because we don't really want to actually incur the costs ourselves. We just like to impose the mandate on others rather than being responsible for it. So without the Green Amendment, I think it's better to state an intention than to do nothing, but the idea that the legislature wouldn't be responsible for appropriating funds for this, it just seems to me is very irresponsible.
Well, Representative Winkler, I don't know if I agree with that, seeing as how I think that most voters would feel that the Secretary of State's office would be the office required to do it. I guess you could make an argument either way, but I think there's a fair argument to be made that people would think that as opposed to the money being appropriated from the general fund. So I see where you're going with this, but I'm not sure I agree. I will be voting against the Green Amendment. Is there any other discussion to the Green Amendment? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to reiterate some of what Representative Winkler said, I think without this amendment, the A2 amendment remains, in my point of view, an unfunded mandate to the Secretary of State's office. And since we appropriate to the Secretary of State's office, I do think that's on our heads. I would like to ask for roll call.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Again, Representative Green, the question again is where the dollars should come from, and I think that some would view that the Secretary of State, voter ID would be a priority of the Secretary of State's office. So I think it's a philosophical question we'll decide here in a minute. Representative Nelson.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess my understanding, maybe I'm all wet on this, but the Secretary of State's office is funded out of the general fund, so mm-hmm. this money, appropriating the money from the general fund to fund this additional burden is something I think we're doing. And again, as Representative Winkler said, it's paying for what we're telling them we want them to do, so I think would be appropriate. So I'm voting for the amendment. I think we should. I support the amendment.
Any other discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you. In speaking with Ms. Dyson here, we, I guess, have some questions, or I have some questions on the language. Maybe we need to clarify the oral amendment here. I guess the way that the oral amendment, at least as I read it right now, says legislature shall appropriate an amount from the general fund to the Secretary of State to cover those costs. It sounds like possibly a clearer way or more direct way would be to say an amount sufficient to pay those costs as appropriated, then make it more of a standing appropriation if there are those costs there. And since we fund the Secretary of State, 6 of 1, 6 of 1 the other, but I think that's...
Representative Green?
That makes a lot of sense. I think that sounds great, and especially, I guess, if it's also additionally clear that we're not just talking about the cost of the doing the survey, but the costs that are teased out by the survey.
Would you report the new language, Ms. Dyson? Representative Sanders, is it your view that this language changes the intent of the Green Amendment?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that it changes the intent.
Clarifies it?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair and members, line 1.8 before the period, insert, and an amount sufficient to pay the costs of reimbursement is appropriated in fiscal year 2012 to the Secretary of State.
Everyone clear on the modification to the oral amendment? Any other discussion? Representative Draskowski, you are still opposed to the Green Amendment, even with the modification. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Seeing no other discussion, the clerk will take the roll on the oral amendment to the A2 amendment.
Chair Pepin?
No.
Representative Murray?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Beard? Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hancock?
Nay.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative McFarland?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
Representative Quam?
Nay.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl? Representative Winkler?
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Back to the A2 amendment.
I have a question.
Representative Scalzi.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just confused. The A2 amendment then as unamended, just says it is intended. What does that mean in legalese? Does that mean they will pay it, or does that mean they have happy thoughts about paying it, or just what does intended mean?
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would defer to Ms. Dyson if intended has any legalese meanings, but I guess the amendment is pretty clear that it is an intention. Believe in the Secretary of State's office that they fulfill their duties and conduct a cost survey as well to determine the appropriate amount.
Ms. Dyson, did you want to add to that if there's a legal, if that is indicated in other places in statute or whatnot?
Madam Chair, I don't know about other places in statute. As Representative Sanders said, this is a statement of intent, but it does have the mandatory provision that the Secretary of State conduct a cost survey.
Madam Chair.
Representative Sanders.
If it helps ease the minds of the committee, and if the author agrees, I could move an oral amendment to the amendment to strike on 1.5, it is intended that, and then strike will and change to an add must. So then it would say the Secretary of State must reimburse costs incurred by the counties. I'm open for a discussion on that if that helps ease the question.
Is everyone clear on the oral amendment, the Sanders oral amendment, the A2 amendment? Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, with this, well, we haven't adopted the oral amendment to the amendment, so I don't know. Maybe are you incorporating this?
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, like I said, I'm open to discussion and to see what the author has to say as well.
Well, yes.
Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Representative Sanders, when you change this, you are now really requiring the Secretary of State to pay out money to local units of government for a mandate that the state of Minnesota, the legislature, is creating. The way the amendment was originally drafted, it was more of a statement of intent, given the fact that we don't know what the total costs are going to be because the bills aren't there. But at least in previous committees, thought it was a good idea to put that statement in law so that we're stating that we're not intending to create an unfunded mandate, but we're leaving it open as to how the funds will become available. As this amendment has taken shape and with your suggested change, you're basically creating an absolute requirement that the Secretary of State, out of their own funds, pay local units of government to implement a policy that the Secretary of State's office has, opposes, actually. But more than that, it doesn't have the funds to cover it. So it seems to me that you're really just taking it out of the hide of the Secretary of State's office if you change this, and you certainly would convert my yes vote to a no on the amendment.
Well, Representative Winkler, I think he did that the comment of Representative Scalzi. So, Representative Sanders, what was your thought on the Winkler comments?
Well, Madam Chair, I share much of his sentiment that I agreed, and originally why I offered it is that we wanted to place the intention there that we don't want undue costs associated with House File 210 to be placed on cities and counties and townships. I think that's an appropriate intent. If there is that much heartache over it, we can certainly withdraw the entire amendment, and we can worry about House. We can approach this as it comes to the House floor. So since there seems to be a lot of heartburn on both sides, I'll just withdraw the A2 amendment.
Okay. The Representative Sanders has withdrawn the A2 amendment. I don't know that there are other, I don't see any other amendments in here, unless I'm mistaken. Are there any others? Okay, Representative Drazkowski, where were we? You went through your bill already. I guess we can take questions, and if I'm not sure if I'd ask if anybody else wanted to testify to the bill that hadn't gotten a chance to say their piece on this bill or the Crawford bill. Come on down. Come on down. You could just identify yourself for the tape before you start.
Good morning, or good afternoon now it is, I guess. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jody Boer with Education Minnesota. And yes, I had planned to get up on the previous bill as well, and so my comments are pertinent to that bill as well. We are speaking in opposition of the repeal of 471-6161, which is the aggregate benefit section. And I would like to just say thank you to Representative Nelson for his amendment that he did try and offer. Mr. Michaels made the comments that expressed our concerns, so I won't repeat them in the essence of time, other than I would just like to reiterate a couple of his remarks that I think require underscoring. And that is, number one, that the real problem that we are dealing with or should be thinking about are the rising costs of health care. As well, some of the proponents of removing this section spoke about that they wanted this because it levels the playing field. I believe Mr. Michaels said that it kicks the person off the field. I would add to that that I think it silences the voice of the other player, and so I don't think it levels the playing field at all. Another supporter of repealing this section said that cities and counties are dealing with increasing costs, and I would also add for your consideration, please, that employees are also dealing with increases in costs. So with that, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you. I ask you to please consider removing this section from the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and again, if you could identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Matt Toburin, and I represent SEIU Local 284, the Union of Public Schools Support Staff, and I also speak on behalf today of AFSCME Council 5, Council 65, and the Minnesota Association of School Employees, School Support Staff. And we just want to go on record for opposing the changes in aggregate benefits for many of the same reasons that have just been outlined. Just want to reiterate that these are health benefits that have been signed by both the employer and employee, a legally binding contract for a period of, in our cases, generally 2 years. And that I just want to say that our members care very, very deeply about the situation that our school districts face as far as funding shortfalls, and are willing and oftentimes work with the employers to come to compromises and to find changes on health benefits and on wages and many other issues to help alleviate this financial strain that all our school districts are under. And our school districts, our employees work with our school districts all the time on health insurance changes. And so we see the need to work with employers on health insurance, but also to take away the fundamental right of collective bargaining by taking away, by making unilateral changes in the midst of a contract is egregious. And I just want to thank Representative Drazkowski for removing the pay equity position pieces in this bill. Speaking from public school support staff, pay equity has been the most effective way to level out the differences in wages between school groups that are male-dominated and female-dominated in our public schools, and we feel that that has been an incredible benefit to employees. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other witnesses or any questions for the witnesses in front of us? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski, back to you.
Madam Chair, I think I don't have any other comments, Madam Chair and members. We've been here long enough, maybe. I ask for your support of the bill.
Madam Chair,
Representative Winkler.
I'd like to request a roll call on the bill and just make the brief comment that rather than looking at this as a local mandate relief bill, I think we should look at this as a bill relieving all the mandates that the author could get passed that he doesn't like, rather than any kind of principle of allowing local units of government to have more flexibility.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Is there any other discussion? Representative Murray then renews his motion that House File 7 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to Judiciary. Oh, I'm sorry. It was Representative Beard. I was out of the room. We will. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pevin?
Aye.
Representative Murray?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Beard? Representative Green?
No.
Representative Hancock?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative McFarland?
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
Representative Sanders?
Yes.
Representative Scalzi?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Erdahl? Representative Winkler?
No.
There being 7 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does prevail, and House File 7 is recommended to pass as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. We do have one final bill on the agenda, and it's getting to be lunchtime, so I would like to take about a half hour so that folks can go check into another committee if they need to and to go get something to eat. So if you get back here about 5 after 1 or so, we'll start back up again. Government Operations and Elections Committee will come back to order. We will be taking up House File 495. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will make the motion that House File 495 be recommended pass and be referred to the General Register.
So moved. Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, looking at the content of this bill, I would think that it would, it's not trivial and would need to go to at least one more committee, and I thought Judicial, or Justice is an appropriate committee to see this as. Anyone spoken to the chair or, about intent?
I have gotten word, Representative Quam, that Judiciary does not need to see the bill and have not received word from anyone else that said they need to see the bill. Am I incorrect?
Madam Chair, my understanding is the same as yours.
And I don't know what other committee might need to see it, but we have not heard from any other chair.
Madam Chair, so this is the only committee that's going to hear this bill before the floor. Is that a correct statement?
That is a correct statement.
Oh, I'm surprised.
Okay, Representative Simon has moved House File 495 be recommended to pass and be placed in the General Register. To your bill, Representative Groffel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate the hearing and the committee's indulgence. Hope everyone had a nice lunch and is well fed and in a favorable mood. Madam Chair, members, quite simply, this bill is a bill that says if you get the most votes, you should win. And we take a look at this and you take a look at what other states are doing. The National Popular Vote Plan does this. It's a good pro-Minnesota bill if you look at the resources that are being expended on a nationwide basis. Disproportionate amount of those resources are being allocated to a small number of states. The state of Minnesota, whether it's competitive or not, this is not good for Minnesota. And so passing a National Popular Vote bill would allow that and put us in parity with other states. And it does it in a way that's completely voluntary. It gives us the opportunity to opt out if it doesn't work for us. And I would ask for member support. And in addition, I have a very capable previous author of the bill, as well as some expert testifiers to answer members' questions. But I'm happy to receive the testimony and answer any questions the chair or members of the committee may have.
Well, I would like to hear a capable legislator address the bill. Representative Simon?
I wasn't talking about Representative Simon.
Oh. Representative Simon, would you like to comment?
Very nice of Representative Garofalo to invite me up here. Yeah, I would. I think this is a fascinating idea. I did carry it in past years. We're trying to export democracy as a country to Afghanistan and Iraq, and I think we'd be hard-pressed to explain why it is that we have the possibility, at least, that the highest vote-getter doesn't win. I understand all the historical reasons behind the way we do it. I think we all understand that. But I think that's really what it's about. It's about fundamental fairness. And just a word about motives, which is probably less in play this year than it has been in the past. This is not sort of Bush v. Gore revenge. It really isn't. John Kerry in 2004 came within 60,000 votes of winning the presidency, though he would have been almost 3 million votes behind George W. Bush, and that would not have been right. In 1992, I deferred law school for a year. I moved to Little Rock, and I worked on the Clinton-Gore campaign. I got down there in early June when Bill Clinton was third in the polls, and the person who was first in the polls was Ross Perot. And there was active talk when I first moved down to Little Rock about the fact that Bill Clinton could still take third place, certainly second place and third place, and still become president of the United States, because if no one got 270 electoral votes, it would be tossed into the U.S. House of Representatives, and of course at that time, Democrats had a pretty overwhelming advantage. And there were people around me in the Clinton campaign who were cheering this on and thought this was a great thing, that Clinton could come in second and maybe even third and be president, and I was horrified. I think that's a terrible thing to have happen to our democracy, whether it's my candidate or not. So going ahead to the future, this isn't about settling scores or, avenging a loss or anything like that. I've just personally always thought that it's the fairest system. So what this does, as Representative Garofalo says, is it basically says that our state will agree to give its electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote, regardless of how that candidate does in Minnesota. And keep in mind, and this is, I think, the key thing to keep in mind, even though we've been conditioned to think that the Electoral College is all about winner-take-all, that is, if you have more votes in a particular state, you get that state electoral votes, and it's true that 48 out of the 50 states today do it that way, including our state, there is no such provision in the Constitution. We can choose, and any state can choose, to allocate its electoral votes any way that it wants. If we, as silly as it sounds, in Minnesota, wanted to say that the tallest candidate will get our 10 votes, we could do that. If we wanted to say that the candidate with the most vowels in his or her name will get our vote, we could do that. So there's nothing in the Constitution. This is not going against anything that the founding fathers, mothers, founders, whatever, wanted. This is simply saying that we're doing what the Constitution already permits us to do. We're not getting rid of the Electoral College. It's saying we're choosing to allocate them in this way. And it's not even binding on us at all. Even if we choose this, if it makes a fast track to the floor, passes the House, Senate, signed by the governor, none of this kicks in at all until 270 electoral votes worth of states also agree to this same compact. We can pull out at any time we want, for whatever reason we want. And so the idea here is just to make sure that we don't have a situation, again, and I don't care who the candidate is, where the second place person wins. Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, doesn't matter. And that's really what's at the heart of this. And so I don't think there's too much more to say other than to hand it over, or Representative Garofalo, to other testifiers.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have some expert testimony here if you'd like to hear from them. It's at the Chair's discretion.
That would be fine. The testimony could come forward. Representative Hancock, did you have a question for one of the legislators?
Yeah, just a question and a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, Tommy isn't here to defend himself, so I don't know if height is going to be appropriate here. You've mentioned several times the winner-take-all in the democratic process. I will remind you, we are not a democracy. We are a representative republic. And while I've listened carefully, and I think there's some merit to the arguments here, it doesn't bother me necessarily that the second place candidate would win in the Electoral College. I think that is, I think we need to preserve the state's rights that are designed, and I think there's some good arguments here to come for that. But I have to be a little bit careful that our main objective here is to become a democracy and export democracy. That is really what we are not. More of a comment than a question.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
And to my my friend from, not Bagley, is it? Bagley?
Near Bemidji,
from way up north. No, I mean, I think it's important to recognize the difference between a direct democracy system and a republic. It's an important note. And the most important thing is with regards to the rights of states and stuff is we retain total control over this. If a constitutional amendment were passed and enacted into law, we would as a state, we would lose complete control over that process. This bill doesn't do that. Minnesota is in complete control. Once the 270 vote electoral vote threshold is in place, there's a window in place to make sure that people don't opt out a week before or a week after the election, so that doesn't take place. But we retain our, for lack of a better word, sovereignty and rights on these matters.
If I could just comment, you make an excellent, thank you, Madam Chair, you make an excellent point. We are a republic, and that's why I think the structure and the framework of this works so well, because we're not, it's not an abolishment of the Electoral College. It's just simply saying, as the founders said, hey, states, you're going to have these electoral votes. You get to decide how to allocate them. This is one possible way to do it, and reasonable people can disagree about how to do it. 48 states, and I guess still, because there aren't 270 electoral votes worth of states, 48 states choose to do winner-take-all, but there's nothing in the Constitution about that. We get the power to do that. That's the only point, but you make an excellent point about our foundational principles.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the record before you begin.
John Koza, I'm the chair of National Popular Vote, and thank you, Madam Chairman of the committee, for the opportunity to speak here today. I'd just like to point out that this bill is now law in 8 states, most recent being Vermont last Friday when the governor signed it. And it has passed 31 chambers in 21 states and has about 2,100 state legislative sponsors around the country, including very recently the Republican Assembly Chairman in California, along with the Democratic Assembly Chairman, and the Republican Speaker of the Missouri House, along with the Democratic Minority Leader, and of course, as you well know, the Speaker of this House, as well as distinguished Republican and Democratic sponsors. So this is a bill that is gaining energy, has roughly 75% support in most states. It's based on the Constitution. It retains the Electoral College. It retains state control of elections. It guarantees that every vote in every state in every presidential election will matter. Here in Minnesota, in the last election, two of the 300 presidential visits and corresponding money was spent in Minnesota. In nearby Colorado, which is slightly smaller than Minnesota, spent in Minnesota. In nearby Colorado, which is slightly smaller than Minnesota, it's 10 times as much money and visits. And basically two-thirds of the money and visits in a presidential campaign go into 6 states. 98% go into just 15 states. So in round numbers, two-thirds of the states are irrelevant in presidential elections right now, basically including your state. And 200 million of 300 million Americans are irrelevant in presidential elections. We would like to change that, and we would like to make every vote equal, as the title of our book says. And by the way, I know the committee has an extremely busy agenda, and I sat through the hearing this morning, so I'm not going to go through the answers to the 91 frequently asked questions.
Thank you.
That are in the book, and that, to my knowledge, only my mother has read, but am available if there's any specific question about any particular area that bothers anybody. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Do you have other witnesses, Representative Garofalo?
Thank you very much.
Yep, just one more testifier,
Madam.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Patrick Rosensteel, Minnesotan, live in St. Paul, and a senior consultant to National Popular Vote. You know, I just underscore three principles that have already been talked about. National Popular Vote does three things in my estimation. One, it preserves the Electoral College and the state power to award electors in a manner they deem is in the best interest of their state, which is important to me as a strict constructionist whose first dog name was Jefferson. Two, it guarantees the presidency to the candidate who gets the most votes in all 50 states. And three, and frankly, most importantly to me, the byproduct of that is it makes a vote in Minnesota always count as much as a vote in battleground Florida, Ohio, or Pennsylvania. And I think the current system, in order to sort of oppose this system, it would require a defense of the current system at some level, and the current system encourages presidents to govern to battleground states. It has a huge impact on public policy. You know, for example, George Bush is all for steel tariffs as he appeals to Pennsylvania steel voters, while he opposes or supports, you know, sort of CAFTA, which would allow Guatemala to dump sugar in the Red River Valley of Minnesota. You know, we passed the Part D prescription drug benefit and spent $978 billion to appeal to battleground voters in the I-4 corridor of Florida. Now, reasonable people can agree or disagree on whether or not a Part D prescription drug benefit makes sense, and that's not what my testimony is about. But certainly American presidents get transactional with battleground voters as it relates to federal policy, and I think that's important to keep in mind. Dr. Kozel referenced the money and where it goes. The truth is it's more than about money, it's about influence. Two-thirds of the voters in this country aren't polled by presidential candidates when they determine what it is they're going to run on. And I think that's a dangerous system for America. I don't think the founding fathers of this country believed in a system where two-thirds of the country would be relegated to flyover status, which is the current system. And I believe that every American, conservative, liberal, independent, moderate, you name it, should be courted by the presidential campaigns. And I think that's good for the constitutional republic that we live in. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony and am available to answer any questions.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions for the witnesses? Is there anybody else that would like to speak in opposition to the bill? No? No discussion whatsoever? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also understand this is a republic. I also understand the reason why we're not a true, straight, pure democracy is because we care about protecting minorities, protecting different groups. When this nation was founded, we had the idea of states' rights and people and citizen rights. Part of the state rights were to protect large states, small states, so size was mitigated by states having rights. Protecting less populous states from more populous states by allowing there to be a Senate that added some balance. It doesn't totally, you know, change the popular. It doesn't override, but it adds a little bit of balance. Being from a rural area, I appreciate balance. In my county, I soon discovered as I was growing up that when the county commissioners, the majority lived in the city of Rochester, the county no longer had representation, that the city of Rochester took and controlled county government as well as the city government. And that was not fair to the residents that lived in the county. There wasn't that balance in that organization. I have concerns that by shifting to a straight popular vote, we dilute some of the granted and associated powers to the states that the founders felt needed to be present in order to maintain the integrity of this republic and allow for it to continue in the future. There have been many democracies in Greece and other countries that have come and gone and haven't had the stability because they did not have that check, that protection for the different areas, that balance for rural versus urban. And we struggle with that in different issues here of rural versus urban. We're going to be doing redistricting. And I'm a firm believer that each Senate seat should, if possible, have a rural and urban House seat in it, so you maintain in the Senate that global sense, that protection of the less populous areas, but they have a different view, a different need on different issues. That voice not be diluted, not go to the wayside because it's not in an urban area. looking at when we had the discussions of getting rid of the Electoral College, there was much debate about going to straight popular elections. And in that debate, it came up that there were a little bit more than a dozen metro areas that if someone was able to achieve 70% to 80% of that vote, they would be the victor. And I think that that causes some angst among some of us, because we know that rural areas need to have somewhat of an equal weight, because their issues are different. And we hear that and see that in the metro area versus outstate. And I like to have a little more balance. And right now, I'm not quite buying the balance that's in this. And I just feel that, you know, I had to speak up and give those concerns.
Representative Grappolo?
Yeah, Madam Chair, my friend from Byron, it's, you know, today's a free fire zone, so it's okay. I understand reasonable people can disagree about it. But I think it's important to note that the balances that you're talking about with regards to sparsely populated, rural populated areas, I mean, the current system really hurts those kind of states. And it hurts places like Minnesota. The testifier brought up the example of Ohio or Pennsylvania and Ohio and the impact of steel tariffs and where that came from. And in the legislative process, we have sort of distributed representation, the balance of small states versus big states, to make sure that in the legislative perspective, we address the concerns, we can take care of making sure that we're not just having the populous big states override them. But when you have the concentrated power of the executive branch, you want them to be looking at a nationwide perspective for policy. Nationwide, what's good for the nation? And another example that someone brought up, a testifier brought up, was the one in Florida, the prescription drug benefit, you know, Part D. And when you look at the slicing and dicing of the demographic patterns in battleground states, I mean, the presidential election, I would even be more aggressive, basically comes down to about 6 or 7 states right now. And you're going to see an increasingly larger focus on a smaller and smaller scope of states. And those states that are being excluded, they're overwhelmingly rural. They're overwhelmingly sparsely populated. And so that's my criticism of the current system. But just to emphasize again to my friend that this bill keeps control of this issue here in Minnesota. No one decides our position in this plan other than us. If we choose to go in, we're in. If we choose to go out, we choose to go out. And I think that's an important part of important component of this bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, very, very valid points. I mean, I do want to point out, as Representative Garofalo did, that I was having a conversation with Ed Schaefer, the former Secretary of Agriculture from North Dakota. He's former governor of North Dakota. North Dakota is flyover. Another example is issues related to the Missouri River. Missouri is a competitive, large battleground state. North and South Dakota are small, reliably red or reliably Republican flyover states. When the Bush administration was negotiating a deal on how we would use the Missouri River as a resource, as a collective resource, those states, he always sided with the state of Missouri. Not because Missouri was big or small, but because Missouri was what is known in political vernacular as a battleground state. And so under the current system, the 12 largest states, or the 12 smallest states, 6 are reliably red, 6 are reliably blue. There's one of the 13 states that has 4 or less electoral votes that's battleground every once in a while, and it's New Hampshire. So under the current winner-take-all rule, based on influence being on how competitive a state is, the 12 smallest states are relegated to spectator status, just like the large state of California is. And I should say that Hawaii and Vermont are small states that have passed this bill. We're currently moving legislation in Alaska, and you know, small states are embracing this because they know they are relegated to flyover status in American politics. That's their experience. As to big cities, the 12 largest population centers, I know that if you add up the 50 largest population centers in America, you have less than 20% of the vote. And so big cities and major urban areas will not control an election under national popular vote. If they would, I'd have to ignore the fact that Tim Pawlenty was elected and reelected governor of the state of Minnesota, despite losing Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, Mankato, and Duluth, the 5 largest cities.
Senator Quam.
Tim Pawlenty won by a margin over around 9 to 10,000 in Rochester, so just to correct you there. But I don't see how this does anything to help, sorry, Madam Chair, does anything to help the low populace, flyover states. I don't see that this changes that status for them at all, because they don't have the population anyway. And, you know, so that's part of the reason is, why do this huge overhaul when I don't see it solving the issue of the flyover of the small states?
Well,
Representative Garofalo.
I'm a, I have a constituent here. Hold on. Sorry, I'm getting texts from my super CLA. The I think, like it or not, in a modern presidential day campaign, and this is just my opinion, I'm happy to defer to the experts on it, that when you look at a modern campaign, media coverage and advertising does have an impact on turnout, and it does drive participation. So what's happening right now is you're having an over, you know, an excessive concentrate, an excessive amount of resources going into a concentrated, limited area to drive turnout. And what you see, in my opinion, is in these, using the term flyover states, a lack of resources, lack of advertising, lack of media coverage, lack of interest, personal visits from candidates, that is having less people participate in that process. And so by having it be a more broadly based arena, in terms of getting more people involved, I think that's good for the process, and I think that's one of the primary reasons why this is a good bill.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if this would be to Representative Garofalo or perhaps to one of the testifiers today. The question I have is, if we have 270 electoral votes committed to the compact, what's the guarantee that there isn't going to be one or more of those states that would appoint members to the Electoral College that would otherwise vote their own independent way, which constitutionally they're allowed to do?
Sure. I will defer to our expert. I'll defer, Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, I'll defer to our testifier on this.
And I'm going to have Dr. Koza answer the question.
Thank you.
Dr. Koza?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and
Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative O'Driscoll, thank you. So you're asking about faithless electors, and we've had 22,000 electoral votes cast since 1789, and of those, only one was a true faithless elector, and that was in 1796. There were nine other grandstanders, about one every 10 or 20 years, who cast a deviant vote, knowing full well that their vote wouldn't matter. Most recently, in 2000, a woman in the District of Columbia refused to vote because she wanted to make the point that the district didn't have any congressmen. And, of course, we are well aware there's one accidental electoral vote out of 22,000 that was cast in 200 years. So the problem of faithless electors is really not a problem, because electors are basically very reliable party people chosen by their political party who absolutely intend to vote that way. But if it is a problem, the states have total control over their electors. In fact, there's a bill floating around that's passed one state from the Uniform Law Commission that makes it even harder for a faithless elector to cast a deviant vote, and would have dealt with the accidental vote in Minnesota that occurred in 2004. So if it is a problem, you all have plenary and exclusive power, according to the Supreme Court, to deal with it. And thirdly, under our bill, in a typical presidential election, the winner will get more than 270 electoral votes, because they're guaranteed 270, which is enough to elect the president, from the states in the compact, and then they're going to get roughly half the other states. So the typical presidential election will give the winner about 400. About 75% of the electoral votes, about 400, creating a huge cushion. And so there's no problem. If there is, you can solve it. And if there is a problem, the National Popular Vote Bill is better than the current system.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. One other just general follow-up question. Have we any indication what the executive branch feels about this under the current administration? Have they telegraphed anything to us?
Dr. Koza?
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, you know, when I was, when Governor Pawlenty was in office, I made a point of not characterizing his position on an issue, either in favor or against it, and I'll maintain that policy today. I would just say that I think the conversations would be ongoing with Governor Dayton, and I'll let him speak to his position on the issue.
More further questions?
Is there any other questions? Representative Hancock.
Thank you. Just it seems to me once the plan would get to 270 delegates, those states then have really exercised their electoral power. But at that point, what we really have then is the popular election of the president. And so whether we achieve, I think this is maybe a better way to get there if that is our objective, than to go through a constitutional amendment, which would take away the states' rights that we're talking about. But the end result that we always talk about here is that we still have then a popular vote that elects the President of the United States. And that's the concept that I'm not sure that I can wrap my arms around yet, in the sense that we, like I said before, we are really not a true, pure democracy in that sense. Would I like the system to work better? Yes, obviously. And to where the small states, the Rhode Island of the gentleman that was here, and back in Wyoming and Alaska that I alluded to, and Minnesota to a certain extent. I would like those states to have the real, true electoral vote that they were entitled to have in the process. And I think ultimately the Democratic vote of the president sort of says the Electoral College is good, and we're preserving that, and that's all fine. But in reality, we have become then a democracy, which really is defeating what our founding fathers really envisioned for us. Again, comments.
Dr. Koza.
Let me just add something about the small states that Pat Rosenstiel started to discuss. They are divided 6-6 by party. In fact, the 25 small states are divided 12 and 13. But focusing on those 13 smaller states, by coincidence, they have the same population as Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania got 40 of the 300 presidential visits and 40 300s of money and attention from the presidential candidates, hence the steel quota from a Republican president. Those 12 small states also have 12 million people by coincidence, and they got either 0 or 1 of the 300 visits because small states are almost all one-party states in presidential elections. So the fact is, a vote in a small state is currently worthless, as is a vote in Texas or California, because it doesn't matter to presidential candidates what the issues are in the 12 smallest states, because they're all predetermined outcomes. So the only way the small states can get influence in the presidential process by making a vote in South Dakota as important as a vote in Ohio or Florida, which it is not now. And that's why, by the way, this bill holds better in small states, why 9 small state legislative chambers have passed it, and why 3 of our 8 enactment states are small states. So this is not radioactive in small states. We get an excellent reception, justifiably, because a popular national vote makes a vote everywhere in the United States politically relevant in every single presidential election.
Representative Erdahl, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and sorry I'm a little late for this, but for 45 minutes I was sitting in 500 South and no one told me that we'd moved.
Well, Representative Erdahl, had you been here earlier, you would have heard that we
Well,
sorry about that. But next time, just for future notice, if you're sitting somewhere for more than, say, 40 minutes, I'd suggest that probably you might want to look around. Just a thought. But anyway, Representative Erdahl.
All right, well, thank you. With Representative O'Driscoll and me, I was catching up a little bit on some of the conversation I'm interested in. although sometimes I don't know if it's a good idea to encourage more presidential candidates to come here. It's kind of nice without them. But is the would the ultimate or the better solution be to just, you know, I understand constitutional amendment difficulties, but not having the Electoral College at all? And maybe you could elaborate a little bit on what the purpose of the Electoral College was in the first place.
Dr. Koza?
Well, the purpose was to have a deliberative body where the wise men, and they were men and rich and white, of course, would deliberate and pick the best person. And that was the intent of the Electoral College, patterned after papal elections or the election of kings, which most kings were elected in Europe at the time of the Constitution. Lately, they've become automatically hereditary, but kings were elected, popes were elected. Founders wanted a deliberative body. However, by the time of the first competitive presidential election, which was 1796, Adams and Jefferson, political parties had formed. And once there were political parties competing for the office of president, the electors became rubber stamps. So, and one by one, the states fell into this winner-take-all rule. Only three states used the winner-take-all rule in 1789. By the mid-1850s, virtually all the states were using it. And the reason was that the political party in control of each state wanted to get 100% of the electoral votes and maximize their clout. And hence, the states had a race to the bottom and adopted the winner-take-all rule. But the founders never intended 100% of the electors of Minnesota to vote the same way. They thought the Minnesota electors would sit down and deliberate who would be the best person for the job. And certainly no extra constitutional body, which is what these nominating conventions are, was going to dictate what 100% of the electors from a given state were going to vote. So what we have is a system now which is totally not what the founders wanted, but a system that was almost inevitable once the political parties came onto the scene.
Madam Chair.
Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, members of the committee. I think it's important to note that originally, when this was set up, they viewed the popular vote as just being just narrowing the field. That's what the purpose of the popular vote was, to narrow it down to, was it? I think it was supposed to narrow down the field, so then these white, these old, wise, rich, white landowning men could, you know, sort of protect the public from their emotions. That was the purpose of it. Was clearly it does not work in a 21st century world that we live in.
Senator Erdahl.
How many? We do have some states that are proportional with their electors today, don't we?
Madam Chair,
Senator Garofalo?
There's Maine and then Nebraska. Maine and Nebraska are the two states I know. Does anyone else? That's it.
Senator Hornstein?
Thanks. I just think this is, we've had a lot of discussion maybe from people that have been uncomfortable with the bill, but I think this is a great bill, and I think it's particularly timely because, you know, we do have a divided electorate. We've had a lot of states that you know, a lot of elections, even in Minnesota, that are decided by several thousand votes. And so in this winner-take-all system, it becomes even more problematic. And so, because it's not just Florida and not just 2000, and I think we're going to see this increasingly in the future. And it's frustrating. And so this is a great solution, and I appreciate the bipartisan nature of the approach today.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, you're in favor of my bill?
Absolutely.
Oh, we're doomed. Yeah. I'm just kidding. Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
Do we have any additional questions? Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to the substance of the bill, but I just wanted to comment as a first-year legislator how comforting it is to see Representative Simon and Garofalo at the table in front of us again. They led our orientation, and it's delightful to see them working in the bipartisan way that they talked about during training.
Representative Green, didn't they tell you it's about Simon and Garofalo? Garfunkelo? Was it?
Madam Chair, I was going to say it's the reunion of Lewis and Clark again.
Mutt and Jeff. There's all sorts of comparisons. Any other members of the audience that wish to comment? Questions? Seeing none, Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 495 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Nay.
Nay. The motion does prevail, and House File 495 is recommended to pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Members, the before I adjourn here, just a little housekeeping stuff. We'll be meeting tomorrow again at the regular time, and again, we'll meet during the day if we don't get through the agenda. And then we will be likely meeting on Friday morning, starting at probably about 9 o'clock in the morning. So if you could just put that in your calendar, more information on that tomorrow or whenever we get it posted. With that, meeting adjourned.